You are listening to CFRU Radio, 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario. June 21st is recognized as National Indigenous Peoples Day in Canada. To commemorate this date, CFRU is, at this point, going to feature a documentary that was put together by a CFRU volunteer named Shonda White and originally broadcast a few years ago as part of a series of programs put together by the National Campus Community Radio Association under the name Resonating Reconciliation. This episode is focused on the effects and legacy of the residential school system in Canada. Please note that this program deals with subject matter that some listeners may find triggering. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1938, the first residential school was opened, and that was through the government, which was not Canada at that time; it was British. We were called Upper and Lower Canada at that time. But the residential school system was introduced. And the way this system was supposed to work was the Royal Proclamation was issued 250 years ago this year. And the Royal Proclamation is a British proclamation, British law, that says that native land in general, cannot be taken or commodified without first consulting native people. And we, the British government, will act on behalf of those indigenous people's interests, native people's interests. So we found that in order for the native people to be understanding of the idea that land is going to be commodified, and that when we enter into a treaty with native people, we're actually asking them to surrender their land. And when they surrender their land, they have to understand what the term surrender means. So we have to educate them. And the way we do that, the way we've chosen, the way the British government has chosen to do that, is to create cultural safety zones, which are called reservations, reserves, in Canada and in the United States. And the children would be taken from the families and put into what are known as residential schools. And the first superintendent of Indian Affairs, his name was Duncan Campbell Scott, he said, he's quoted as saying, in order to solve the Indian problem, we have to kill the Indian and save the child.
Stomp out any like Indianness or any of their culture or any of their heritage out of them so that they can fully assimilate. So they did that through many different types of ways of like, you know, straight different torture exercises, if you want to call them that, or whatever, different torture devices, and also through like, you know, mental, sexual, and physical abuse. And just straight up, first thing that they did was cut your hair, no matter who you were. And if you spoke your language, you were beaten or like severely corporal punishment. And you know, any attempt at someone trying to express their culture was snuffed out pretty quickly.
I think it's like after, you know, at that point, like it's sort of 500 years of attempted genocide, we were still here and we were still surviving through all these attempts at genocide. And what was keeping people together was community and family, and that sense of family that, you know, in Indian country, family means something different. You know, family is not just, you know, blood relation, it's the people around you, it's your community, it's the people who take care of you and who you take care of. So that idea, that sense of community and family kept us strong, kept us alive. So when it got to that point where it's like, oh, all this genocide isn't working, we can't kill them all, we can't get rid of them all, well, let's attack that family structure and let's take away people's ability to be families and to have a community. So how do you do that? You take the children away and you put the children in a situation where they don't know their culture, where they don't know how to be a family anymore, and you hold them there until they're adults and then you release them back into the community.
Yeah, completely institutionalized.
Like all that stuff I was saying before about this being, you know, the final step or the final attempt at wiping out Aboriginal people, you know, that final stage of the genocide, it didn't work. We survived it. But surviving it isn't thriving. Surviving it is just making it through something. So what we're dealing with now is the fallout of that. So yeah, all those things that are put on the Aboriginal community as being our problems with our community, with alcohol abuse, with drug abuse, with all this stuff that stems from that attack on community, that attack on family, is now blamed on the victims. Mm-hmm. You know, so all those problems, and this is one of those things that I think, you know, people in Canada, people in North America really have to realize, is that these are outcomes. This isn't how that our community can't handle these things or isn't able to function. It's that we've had our ability to function taken away. And what's really exciting right now is watching how that healing is happening and how people are becoming strong again. And then now, you know, the residential schools are finally over. So people, you know, none of us went to residential school, you know, so we don't have that direct experience now, so that healing can start. You know, when you're dealing with that kind of trauma in your life, you know, it's hard to come to a point of strength beyond that. So it becomes up to the generations after and the generations after now to pick up the pieces and put stuff back together and become a whole society again, become a whole community.
School life is a time full of numbers and words. We'll listen and look so to learn. With eyes to the future, for that's where we'll be. When time slips on past and it's our return.
Chapters in Canadian history, that there would be a systemic approach to eradicating the culture and language of taking the Indian out of the child. It is horrific, both for the children that were taken and the families that were left behind. You know, an apology from the Prime Minister about this means absolutely nothing until all Canadians understand about this chapter. I'm very, very worried that what was set up because of the legal obligation of Canada with the Judge Iacobucci's negotiation that meant there would be an apology, there would be a commission, that we now are facing a situation where I do not believe the commission has the money to do its job properly. It, because of its slow start, it doesn't have the time to do it properly, and it doesn't have the access to the documents that it needs. I mean, it's absolutely appalling that the commission has had to go to court to get the documents it needs, meaning we don't just need documents from the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. These have to be the documents from the RCMP, from all the other government departments that were implicated in this tragedy. And so I'm very, very worried that if this isn't done properly, and that again, this will be such a serious, serious responsibility and obligation of Canada that will not be able to do the job it was supposed to have done.
When I was growing up, there was nobody practicing ceremonies, and nobody singing drum songs. The community was pretty much run by the church. The things that the church did, the Catholic Church, were things that involved all the Native people and the non-Native people. So they would have community gatherings, they would have bingos, they would have potlucks. I remember one time they had this procession in the bush where they had the signs of the cross there. I think that's what it was called. And so I remember my mom and I went, and I was only maybe about 8 years old, and I remember saying to my mom, well, what did the Indian people do a couple hundred years ago? And my mom used to always be so exasperated because they always asked her questions like that. And so I kind of made it my priority in life to find out. We had a wood stove, and there was always something on the stove, like maybe there was blueberry sauce. And when people came over, we'd make a fresh batch of dumplings. So we'd have blueberry dumplings, or we'd have cake, or we'd have pie. But my mom always told me and my sister Debbie to make sure that we served the elders when they came in, make sure they had their tea and coffee and their pie or their cookies, whatever. And so this gave me the opportunity to ask them questions, but a lot of them didn't have answers to questions that I wanted to know about. And then when I was older, I was still searching, and then when I met Dan, we were both searching for the same thing because he was looking for it too. And so on our second date, we found out that we had both been in a sweat lodge. And so that really bonded us together. And so from that time on, from the first time we met, we've been walking together and sitting with elders and searching out elders and finding the answers to the questions that we've had. You know, and this has taken up a great part of our life, going to ceremonies and sitting with the elders and learning. And so that's been practically our whole life journey. And then now we've been sharing what we've been learning with the youth. And I don't see very many people our age trying to help the youth, but I remember the elders used to always say we have to worry about the next seven generations to come. And I hardly see anybody talking about that, you know, or trying to let the kids know that that's what we have to do. So we talk about it a lot, and we meet with students at university, but we also are going to elementary schools and talking to the youth there, the Native and non-Native as well, you know. And so I think we are making a difference in people's lives. But if it hadn't been for the turn, like the things that happened in my life, then I probably would have had a different life, different way of life.
If I could put my finger on it, I really would like it if there was more education towards understanding the culture and the language and people being able to kind of embrace that without any sense of stigmatism or feeling that it's not worthy or that, you know, maybe that's the past, it's no longer worthwhile looking into. Instead of embracing it as something that is maybe even avant-garde and something useful to carry in one's life. In terms of, for example, cultural funding, I find that disappointing that we haven't really produced enough cultural funding to support the initiatives that we could have out for Indigenous people right now. The other thing is that we get a lot of funding, for example, for multiculturalism, and we have a lot of support for various languages and being able to provide classes for those people, as long as you have enough students to want to learn those languages. But when it comes to Indigenous languages, we just don't seem to have that funding out that would be available for these people to learn the languages that they could use and particularly have lost. My family's still looking into whether we do have Indigenous heritage. As far as we're concerned, we're a part of the community, and it's always great to have our extended family and people who have just welcomed us with open arms to be a part of their community. So as far as we're concerned, you know, we're already a family with those people, and it's just good to be a part of that.
Grandmother only spoke Ojibwe. She never learned. She never learned English. And then in between, so my great grandmother never learned English. My grandmother knew English, but mostly spoke Ojibwe. And then her first two kids out of eight spoke Ojibwe. They taught Ojibwe to like my uncles. But the Catholic school told my grandparents not to teach anybody else English or Ojibwe, because it's really bad and they're getting in trouble in school and all that. So I don't know my language. And I knew my great-grandmother, who never learned English, right? So, like, I met her. I used to go to her house and stuff. So it's that close, like, losing the connection to our language.
Thank you.
I think it's run so deep that some people don't even know they're affected by residential schools. I mean, whatever Mi'kmaq traditions my family should have, they didn't get passed down, and I don't know why. And so I assume it's because somewhere down the line, someone in our family was forced into a residential school, and those traditions were lost. I am lucky enough to know that it's in my blood, even though I didn't find out until I was, a little older. But, you know, some people go almost their whole life without knowing. There's probably people who have died without knowing. That's generations of families who will never, ever know that it was in their blood. My family isn't ashamed to be Aboriginal, but I don't consider them to be proud either. And the reason is because they don't know anything about it. They don't get it. They don't know what they've lost. How are you supposed to be proud or even ashamed of something if you don't know what it is? You can't. You can't pass along something if you just don't know what it is, and you don't know how to feel about it, and you don't know how to interpret it. And on the other side of it, you know, there's people ready there to question you about it, and you don't have the answers. That's what's scary, and that's what often I feel holds me back from even exploring my heritage, is that there's always someone there to make you prove yourself. And I don't want to feel like that. And I don't want other people to feel like that.